call to order the House Rules of Election and Public Affairs Committee, and we will open a hearing on House Bill 333. Mr. Harvey. Give me a second, would you please?
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 3333 creates 7-member State Board of Interior Design appointed by the governor, defines an interior designer, and sets requirements for education experience. Talks about civil penalties with a minimum of $100 and a maximum of $500. And we have some amendments. That's 2 amendments. Requires that the Department of Consumer Affairs to research the needs of licensure and regulation of interior designers and authorizes to request up to $10,000 for project research.
Mr. Harvey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Larry Harvey. I'm here today representing the Oregon Coalition of Professional Interior Designers. You are receiving from the committee assistance a core study document of exactly what consists of interior design, just by way of a brief explanation as to how this particular proposal came to this committee. We've had extensive public hearings and additional testimony in the Consumer and Business Affairs Committee. Representative Beyer and his committee was gracious enough to sit through exhaustive testimony explaining exactly what the career does and what professional interior designers would be responsible to know. However, in consideration with a variety of other interested parties around the state, including retailers and academicians, et cetera, we have come to an agreement that rather than pursue the immediate passage and implementation of legislation that would enact a board, we would work through the Department of Consumer and Business Affairs and the 3 universities that offer degrees in interior design in the state, as well as the retail industry from which we most interior designers purchase their goods, to make sure that we have left no stone unturned in reviewing all the issues. The folks that I work with, professional interior designers, are convinced that there is more than enough evidence to proceed with this, but we are willing to build consensus and work more closely and bring you back some additional information, including more specific recommendations to whether the board, if it were created, should be within building codes or the Department of Consumer and Business Services, et cetera. So, as you can see from your sign-up, the building codes was here. The woman that was here representing the building codes division needed to leave. She said she was here to available to answer questions I won't necessarily speak for, but they will respond to any other specific questions that you have. And, of course, I believe Board of Architectural Examiners evidently not in favor of gaining any more knowledge in the subject area, so as you can see, they will oppose doing any more study whatsoever in this state. So they would definitely be opposed to that, but it's not my job to present their case here. I will be happy to answer any other questions that you might have, though.
Mr. Chair, having sat through, as Mr. Harvey said, hours of testimony and my fact machine ran it over twice to see all the input from the people in the profession, I would be thrilled to go on the work session and move the -2 amendments and move the bill to the floor. Unfortunately, we're a little short on the quorum.
We need 3 more votes, and the staff got looking for some votes. So,
do you have a fiscal?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, as is stated specifically in the amendments, the only fiscal impact, it would be minimal. I won't tell you that there is none. But the -2 amendments stipulate that whatever the cost of the study is, it cannot exceed $10,000. If it were for some reason to go beyond that, I have assurances from members of the Professional Interior Design Coalition that they would underwrite any additional cost.
Sure.
Yes,
Mr. Harvey, and I know it's unfair to ask you to put on your opposition's case when it appears, and I don't know whether they are or they're not here, but why is it that the Oregon Board of Architect Examiners opposes this issue? Are they here? Are they present? Are they going to testify? Architect Examiners?
I don't see
them. I could probably say something like that. I've listened to their case once before. Probably we want to have Mr. Harvey to present the opponent's
Thank you, Rex. Please tell us why they don't want to hear any more information.
The architect board simply feels that it's unnecessary to license interior designers because they feel that interior designers, in a sense, work for architects, and I think it becomes a turf battle that the MAC is going to make what comes down to.
Okay.
I might add, if I could, that was an excellent answer, one that I probably would not have felt comfortable giving. But, Mr. Chair, I might also add that one of the problems that we face in Oregon has been faced in 33 other states where this type of legislation has already been passed, is that there is a tremendous amount of confusion between what an interior designer does and what the academic qualifications are for that profession and interior decorators. The folks that are promoting House Bill 3333 are not interested in precluding folks from practicing their businesses. They are not interior decorators. They are interior designers. A good example of that, Representative Williams, is at the University of Oregon, offers a 5-year degree course with extensive training in interior design. And the folks who graduate from that course are able to understand and accurately reflect building codes and design and ADA requirements that should be met within the context of construction, and that's interior design. Space arranging and picking out pastels and curtains is interior decorating, and we're not interested in regulating that at all. We're interested in talking about what should be the minimum competency level for someone who's doing work in a fire life safety area.
Further questions from the committee?
Only to say, Mr. Chairman,
yes,
that if somebody was going to do something with respect to interior decorating, the person who was in the wounds of this castle would probably deserve a prison sentence.
We represent Piercy is next door in the other committee, Mr. Chair.
Yes, I understand that. Next door in the Human Resources, I'm sure. Anybody opposed me? Okay.
Yeah. No, there is.
Okay. Mr. Chair,
yes,
we close the public hearing. Come back to it.
Yeah, we'll recess the public hearing. Before we do that, though, is Peggy Collins here or Jeanette Cortell?
Okay.
We will recess the public hearing pending the arrival of more members of the committee. And we will now go into a public hearing on House Bill 3628, Representative Gianella. Good afternoon, Dennis, of course. Could you give us an update on an overview of this bill, please? 3628.
Chair and committee members, House Bill 3628. It deals with athlete agents for making certain types of contracts with student athletes. And currently, there are no laws governing the violation by these agents for NCAA rules. And there are two amendments related to this bill. The Dash 1 amendments require the athlete agents to apply for athletic agent permits with the Secretary of State to establish a fee structure and establishes a relief for damages in the case of these agents violating these rules. And the Dash 2 amendments provide exemption for teams who may have an agent dealing with them one particular type of sport, and then we deal with another sport of recreation.
Yeah. For the record, my name is Sepsuli Gianella, and I'm state representative for District 38. Mr. Chair, colleagues, I'd like to thank you for hearing this bill. My legislative assistant, Tim Laurie, came to me with this idea for the bill. He was watching a show called Outside the Lines on ESPN about student athletes and athlete agents. He found that Oregon is one of the 22 one of 22 other states that does not have any law that punishes agents for breaking NCAA rules in regards to conduct with student athletes. He's done a lot of research on the bill, and we have worked with NCAA along with Oregon State University and University of Oregon to make sure that this bill is in the best interest of student athletes and schools. I'd like to introduce my legislative assistant, Tim Lurie, who will give you more details about this bill. Thank you. Tim?
For the record, my name is Timothy Lurie, and I am the legislative assistant for Julie Gianella, the state representative for District 38, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. As President Gianella told you, I found that Oregon does not have any law that would punish these agents for breaking NCAA rules by giving athlete agents or student athletes gifts in order to increase the chance that the student will sign a contract with that agent to represent him or her in contract negotiations for professional sports. The NCAA rules state that the moment that a student signs a contract with an athlete agent for representation, that student is no longer eligible to play collegiate sports for any college that is associated with the NCAA, for example, Oregon State University or University of Oregon. It is also against NCAA rules for any student athlete to receive money, gifts, or gifts from an athlete agent. If the school or NCAA finds out that the student has received a gift from the agent, the school and the student usually gets punished. What typically happens is that the sports program in which the student is active in is not allowed to participate in postseason competition. This can be bowl games for college football or tournaments for men's and women's basketball. This means that the school can lose thousands of dollars, hundreds of thousands of dollars in revenues from national televised games. Also, the school would lose top recruits to other schools because the punishment may make the suspected students think twice about attending that particular school. The student that takes the gift is punished by not being allowed to participate in that sport. Typically, these agents prey on high-profile students who know that they will make millions of dollars when they get to the professional level. So an agent or someone who represents an agent, they're sometimes called runners, will approach these students and tell them that the school will make thousands of dollars off them that they deserve to be paid. So the agents will offer the students money or cards or even little things like phone cards, each of which are a violation of NCAA rules. It is hard for these students to turn down large sums of money or even fancy cards, so they give in. So what happens is that the student and the school are punished, but the agent who initiated the incident gets away without being punished. What may end up happening is the agent may make tens upon hundreds of thousands of dollars off that student when he or she becomes a professional athlete, and the school and student get punished. What this bill does is make it illegal for an athlete agent to give money or gifts to students. This bill also outlines the ways in which an agent may or may not be able to contact a student, and the way that a student may be able to sign a contract with an agent. Unfortunately, the bill has no teeth to it, and as it stands right now, there are no penalties to this bill. This bill is basically a copy of California's law, but after talking to the NCAA, Oregon State University, and University of Oregon, we drafted some amendments. The -1 amendment makes this bill more like Tennessee's law, which is regarded as one of the best in the nation. The -1 amendment requires an athlete agent to apply for an athlete agent permit with the Secretary of State. The prospective agent also has to submit a $250 permit fee with the application, and this is paid regardless if the Secretary of State issues or denies the permit. 1 year after the agent receives the permit, it will expire, and the agent may choose to renew the permit for another $100. This amendment will make it a Class A misdemeanor for a person to act as an agent without a permit. Under the -1 amendment, if an agent does give a student athlete money or gifts, and then the NCAA punishes the school and student because of the agent's actions, the school will have a cause of action to seek damages or equitable relief against the agents. Not only will the agents be held financially responsible for violating the rules, but this amendment makes the agents' actions a Class C felony. I have discussed this with Mitch Barnhart, the athletic director at Oregon State University, and he was very animate about making this a Class C felony because the unethical agents are going to ignore the law and take their chances because the positives majorly outweigh the negatives. The reason that we feel that this needs to be a felony is that the typical agent makes 4% off the athlete's contract. That means if an athlete signs a contract for $1 million, that agent will receive $40,000. If a student athlete is a high-profile athlete like University of Oregon's Akili Smith, who's a third player drafted into the NFL this past year, and the agent stands to make hundreds of thousands of dollars off this athlete. If the harshest penalty is only a misdemeanor and the agent would only have to pay a small fine and serve no jail time, and if they get caught, the agent would take the small fine and still interfere with the student if they had the opportunity to make much larger sums of money. These agents do not have the student's best interest in mind. We also have a -2 amendment, which would allow an exception for those students who have an agent for one sport but are still eligible for another sport. The NCAA permits a student who is represented by an agent in one sport to compete in another, so long as the agent contract specifies the sport in which the agent, which the athlete is represented. The most significant for the two sport athletes were one of the sports is baseball. An example of this is Matt Smith, who's a linebacker for the University of Oregon, and he is also a professional baseball player. -2 amendments will provide for such an exception, so it will also allow for protection of those students from being contacted by any other agent regarding those other sports. And I would just like to point out that we have worked with the NCAA, the University of Oregon, and Oregon State University to make sure that this bill is in the best interest of the students and the schools. This is a good bill, and I urge you to adopt the -1 and 2 amendments. Thank you.
All righty. Questions from the committee? President Byer?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Does this apply to people who live out of state and also then that don't reside in Oregon?
Mr. Chair, President Byer, yes, it does. It applies to anybody that goes to school in the state of Oregon.
Okay. Another one, Mr. Chair?
Yes, President Byer.
What about, I know that it's become overtrained with athletes where they have a family member representing them, something like that, where they're not a special agent, that they are an uncle, a dad, a cousin, a brother. They only do it for that one person. They also have to do this.
Mr. Chair, Representative Byer, I believe that there are exceptions in the bill that will allow for parents. I think parents were excluded, I believe, in the bill.
We will look for that. And then also, we're going to start with the question.
You know, talk to the Secretary of State about whether they're going to have to end this program permit process?
No, I did not.
Yes, Mr. Starr.
Do the Secretary of State offer other these kinds of permits in other areas?
I work on Starr. Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't know that answer. We basically copied Tennessee's law, which made it to the, went to their Secretary of State. So, I didn't check on that.
Any further questions from the committee? Okay, I will note for the record also that we had Kirk Bailey from the University of Oregon sign up to testify in favor, and Michael Beachley. LSU Benton in also here to testify in support that they had to leave. So if there are no further questions from the committee, we can take time to digest this further, or if it's agreeable to the committee, we'll move the bill.
I'd be interested, Mr. Chair, to know if the Secretary of State set up to do this kind of committee. It seems to me that it might not be the appropriate choice. I don't know if they do this kind of thing, but it's an opportunity for other, any other things that we commit.
Mr. Chair, Representative Starr, we will check on that. Get back to you.
Okay. For the season, we'll hold the bill in for future work, and
let you come in and get the answer to those questions and just get back to you. There's one question about parents being eligible and one about the accreditation. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll close the public hearing then on House Bill 3628 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 606. So you have kind of testifying that. Can you give us an update on that? We had Tom Barrows, we had a number of people. So go ahead and give us an update on review on how Senate Bill 606. And Tom Barrows, you be coming forward, please.
Yeah, you're right.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 606A changes the definition of society advisory to include the ankle and tenants directly attached to the governing system of the press. HC 3227 was introduced during the 1995 legislative session, and this project has been worked on before, so it's coming before the committee again. SC 606 incorporates the recommendations for current statute.
Mr. Barrow.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Tom Barrow, representing the Oregon Podiatric Medical Association. Senate Bill 606 does two things. One, it seeks to clarify the scope of practice for podiatric physicians in Oregon. Presently, the scope is ailments of the human foot, and that's not well defined, so it's led to some questions about just what it's covered. The other thing it will do is it will allow the Board of Medical Examiners the right rules to determine what qualifications a podiatric physician must possess in order to perform ankle surgery in the state. The Board of Medical Examiners has with some changes that have been made over the last few years, have said that they're okay with this version of the bill. A report has been written out of an interim study from 2 interims ago, which is included in your packet, which outlines on page 2 the criteria that they would deem necessary for a podiatric physician to do surgery. It's very restrictive. Only a few in the state qualify. And then also there's a map in your packet which shows that the map shows 33 other states, actually 34 other states include ankle, and it's double promises for podiatric physicians, so it's just not setting any trend. With me is Dr. Gerald Peterson, legislative chair for the association, and former representative Mary Alice Ford, who has to come up with us because of the late hour, which is as well.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I am Dr. Gerald Peterson, and I'm immediate past president of the Oregon Podiatric Medical Association, and also the current legislative chair, as Mr. Barrow has indicated. And I'm here to present testimony on support of Senate Bill 606, which, as Tom indicated, is designed to try and clarify the scope of practice for podiatric medicine. For many years, podiatric physicians have treated the foot and ankle in our state, but the surgical procedures on the ankle have been unclear as to where the foot and ankle ends and where the leg begins, and what structures are within that definition. This bill will get rid of those gray areas and clearly define and limit the podiatric physicians to the treatment of the foot and ankle. Podiatric physicians are trained under a four-year program after attending 4 years of undergraduate school. The first 2 years mirror the training of the allopathic and osteopathic physician with courses in anatomy, physiology, pharmacology, general medicine, etc. The next 2 years are spent focusing on the lower extremity conditions, especially the foot and ankle, from surgery to treatments of manifestations of systemic medical diseases such as gout, diabetes, and arthritis. Then the podiatric physician will pursue a residency from 1 to 4 years. Surgical certification is then achieved through examination. There is only one recognized certifying board in podiatric surgery, and that is the American Board of Podiatric Surgery. Cases are submitted to document training and expertise, and then you sit for both written and oral examinations to obtain that certification. Our critics say the public is at risk if podiatric physicians are allowed to perform ankle surgery. If that premise is true, why are the 33 other states that currently allow ankle surgery by podiatric physicians not rescinding their laws, and why did Arkansas just become the 34th state to clarify its law to include the ankle? The impact on our current practitioners is minimal. As Mr. Barrow said, there's probably only about 5 to 8 physicians who would even qualify currently in our state, and they obviously also have to go through the credentialing process at the hospital, like all other physicians would who obtain those privileges. Ladies and gentlemen, we are losing highly trained and skilled podiatric physicians to other states because of the lack of clarity in this law. This is not in the best interest of your constituents. They deserve the right to choose the most highly trained providers for their foot and ankle care. podiatric physicians who will perform ankle surgery will be trained with a minimum of 2 years of surgery in just the foot and ankle, as the rules currently agreed to by the Oregon Board of Medical Examiners and the Oregon Podiatric Medical Association stipulate. Our orthopedic counterparts may spend 4 years in their residencies, but how much of that time is spent in just the foot and ankle? I suspect not 2 years. I ask for your support both in this committee today and also on the House floor. Thank you very much, and I'll entertain any questions the committee has.
Questions from the committee at this point?
I have a bit.
Not yet. Listen, Edward.
Yes, you mentioned that other states have similar laws. Are there variations amongst those?
The verbiage is very slightly from state to state, yes. And that we have developed, I was on a committee called the Project 2000 Committee for our National Association, and drafted the National Scope of Practice, where we went through basically 2 years of debate, a pretty large committee composed of podiatrists, educators, insurance people, and an orthopedist. The orthopedist actually is one of the more well-renowned orthopedists in the country, who also is director of one of the foot fellowships that the orthopedists have to specially train orthopedists in foot and ankle surgery. And he was the one that basically helped us, again, to define that.
Can I interrupt you for just a minute? I've been led to believe from conversations earlier that there are some compromise going on, compromise language between those who oppose and those who support this bill.
Mr. Chairman, we feel this version is the compromise. This was begun two sessions ago, and we've worked with the OMA and the Board of Medical Examiners to try and come up with a conclusion to that. The board has brought up.
It will be ready for us today then, to vote on.
Pardon me?
The compromise you're talking about will be ready.
Well, the version, the AMGROF version you have, is the compromise that we've agreed to and the Board of Medical Examiners agreed to. I do not believe that the orthopedists have agreed to this.
Okay. We're under a call. And we've all got to run back to the floor again.
Is it his?
Pardon me.
Can we do 33-33?
Yeah, can we do 33-33? We've got.
I'll take that for a second.
We will have to recess the public hearing on Senate Bill 606 and reopen the public hearing on House Bill 2. Work session may on House Bill 3333. The motion. Here we have the death to amendment. Oh, you heard the motion. Is there any objection? So moved. Mr. Starr. We've as amended. Okay, we have a motion to move House Bill 3333 as amended to the floor. We do pass recommendation for the dash 2 amendment. Is there any further discussion? Any objection? Hearing none. So moved. And House Bill 3333 goes to the floor of the House. We do pass recommendation. You volunteer for the carrier. Okay. Well, Mr. Starr will be the carrier, and the work session is closed. Yeah. And our hearing will reset. Order. And we're in public hearing on Senate Bill 606. I'll reopen the public hearing on Senate Bill 606. And Dr. Gerald Peterson was in the middle of answering questions. And were there further questions for Dr. Peterson? And we have former representative Marianne Ford.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. You have no idea how happy I am to see your faces right now. I hope you have a more productive day than some of us had. But having been there, I understand, and waiting is the name of the game, and to get to testify, the wait is worth it. My name is Mary Alice Ford. I live in Beaverton, Oregon. I was in the legislature from House District 8 for 16 years. 14 of those years, I was on the House Human Resource Committee for 4 years vice chair, and for the last 4 years, from 91 to 95, I was the chair of Human Resources, where we dealt with all of the medical issues, among other things. I also was on the Labor Committee for 2 terms, and then on the interim select committee on workers' compensation. So I've had a lot of background, both as a legislator and, unfortunately, as a consumer of health care. Turf battles were the first two words I learned when I started in 1979. Nobody wants to deal with turf battles. Certainly no legislator in his or her right mind wants to deal with turf battles. But that is the role that has been given to us when we are legislators. It's statutory that the chickens, that the hen box, ought to top guard the hen house. In other words, those who are regulated should not be governing themselves. But we, the people, select and voted in elected choices, are the ones who need to watch the practitioners for the defense of the public. The boards, the Board of Medical Examiners, all of the associations are supposedly there to protect not the people whom they regulate, but to protect the public. That's why in the early 80s we went to having public members on every single state board or agency. Yes, when you are on one of those boards, you become very personally involved and close friends with those who are also on your board. So that takes a little of the watchfulness of the public person away. Now, nothing is worse to deal with than the healthcare issues, because a legislator will think, I'm not a doctor. I'm not a member of any healthcare profession. What do I know? They treat me. Well, the problem is, yes, that is true. They treat you, but you also, especially in this day and age, have to become a good person to understand what your practitioner is doing. You don't get the personal care you should because it's just the sign of the times. And so you have to care more about, quite frankly, sometimes prescribing yourself for non-prescription medications and sometimes diagnosing in order to go where to go or what doctor to see. Now, if you're an HMO, you're told where you can go, which may or may not be the best thing for you. As an example of that, I was not interested in podiatry at all in my life because I've never been referred to a podiatrist. I've never had a foot problem. In 1987, I ran a needle into my foot, running barefoot across my bedroom floor, and it was extremely painful. I pulled it out, but it didn't have a head on it. The pain was excruciating. By the next morning, my foot was swollen double, and I couldn't bear to touch it. I went to an emergency service, and they said, after an x-ray, you have a needle in your foot. Part of a needle in your foot. I said, I thought so. Take it out. They said, oh, no, we can't do that. We have to refer you to an orthopedist. I said, okay. They referred me to an orthopedist, and I made an appointment. A few days later, I got in to see him. And he said, oh, more x-rays, by the way. I can't take it out. Now, you've got to be strong like the men in the service when they get shrapnel. Because they live with metal in their body, and it'll work its way out. I said, that's nice. Where does it work its way out on my foot? What do I walk on while this is happening? He said, well, I don't know, but we can't take it out. A week later, I went into another orthopedist on my own. That orthopedist, I had the x-ray. I didn't have to have a third set of x-rays. That orthopedist said, we can't take it out because we'd have to cut on the bottom of your foot. We cannot guarantee that will heal properly because you'd be walking on it, even with the cast, and you'd end up with a bigger scar and probably more pain than you now have. Well, I know he didn't know what kind of pain I had because I thought at that time anything would be better. This was in May. I gave up on them. I could not wear anything but thongs. Thank God it was warm. And I could wear those because nothing was over my foot. I went to Hawaii to visit my folks for 6 weeks. They lived there. My mother was still there. And every now and then, I'd move my foot the wrong way, and it was the excruciating pain, like hitting a crazy bone. And the throbbing would start and go on for an hour, or 24 hours. So this morning, it happened. and I had to take my mother to her ophthalmologist. And I drove into Hilo, and I go limping in with my mother, and the eye doctor looked at me and said, "What's the matter with your foot? You're limping." And I told him, he said, "Why haven't you been to a podiatrist?" I go, "I'm awfully sorry, but in Oregon, doctors don't refer you to podiatrists, and I don't know any." He said, "Well, I want you to know here in Hawaii, if we have a foot problem, we go to a podiatrist." And he said, "I think you better get to one fast." I came back to Oregon, didn't know one. I happened to have friends in Beaverton whose son was in podiatric school in San Francisco. So I called them and I said, "Can you recommend a podiatrist to me in Beaverton?" They did. I went to him within the day or so. Now, we're talking, this is a period of 2 months. I went in to him, and he said, "You've got a needle in your foot. We're going to take it out." I said, "Thank God." And he said, "Can you be ready tomorrow?" And I said, "Yes." And I was. And the interesting thing is, it wasn't the podiatrist who was with me when I came out of the anesthetic. It was the anesthesiologist who said, "It never would have worked itself out of my foot. It was embedded in bone. It had gone through a nerve like thread through an eye of a needle, which is why I was having such extreme pain. It had deteriorated the nerve a half inch on either side, and it was rusting inside my foot." I was very close to very, very severe problems with that foot. And the irony is that after treatment was so good that the cast was changed every 2 days, little half cast. And I've showed people today, if I was on, you can't see any scars. And I've never had any problems. I became a believer in podiatry. And I became a believer then that this turf battle system was not anything to do with what was good for the public or what was the best procedure for the public. It had to do with salty competition. And what is usually the result of competition? Money. So I became at that point very leery of a bunch of statistics thrown at me, a bunch of garbage about the witch doctors are going to get you because they don't have the education we have. And that brings me to the friend of mine whose son was in podiatric school. He then went, after he graduated in San Francisco, he went and spent a residency, a full residency, in Pennsylvania. Specialty on the ankle. Now, I don't know about you, but this is connected to both my arm and my hand. And my ankle is connected to both my foot and my leg. I don't really believe you can say that one needs to stop there and the other one needs to stop there. Come on, your foot and your ankle work together with the tendons and the ligaments and the bones. So this young man comes back with a specialty in ankle. He comes back to his home state. He can't practice here, but he wants to practice on the ankle. So, of course, that's what he's been specially trained for, so he moves to Vancouver. He has his office in Vancouver, Washington. Well, we're losing his income tax, but we're also losing a good family in Oregon. The irony is, this young man is on the staff at OHSU. He teaches orthopedists to work on the ankle. Is that not a very strange situation? But he can't practice it, but he can teach. Then yesterday I learned of another, from a friend of mine who had a podiatrist in Beaverton, and she had just the day before gone to a new one. The old one had left his practice and moved to Wyoming, and the new one had left Wyoming and bought the practice here in Beaverton. But she knew that I was interested in his film. She asked him about it. He said, "Yes," he said, "I do work on the ankle. I have gone through residency. My specialty is the ankle, but I can't practice here in Oregon." She said, "Well, what do you do?" And he said, "Well, when my patients have a problem with the ankle, I take them out of state for service." I don't think this is good policy for the people. It may be great for the OMA, but it is not good for the people of Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you. And any questions for Ms. Ford? Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Just one last closing comment. There's been some questioning, I guess, as to whether or not the podiatric physicians currently treat ankle non-surgically, and I just wanted to clarify that. I've been in practice now 20 years, and I've been treating the ankle non-surgically for all that time, simple ankle sprains, non-displaced fractures. The question in our concern here is the surgical treatment of the ankle from the standpoint of displaced osseous fractures and those sorts of things. But we want to clarify and make sure that it is indeed in the scope and clear as to that definition. We're not desiring to do the knee and or the leg. We want to just basically do what we're trained to do. Thank you.
I have one more thing, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
I had a letter passed out that Representative Luke issued the last session talking about you brought up the issue of compromise, that we had been working to compromise both two sessions ago and last session, and this sort of, I think, clarifies his position as chair in human resources two sessions ago, that he wanted to see some positive resolution to this, and it wasn't seen that last session.
Thank you very much. And listening back, I just have, I guess, a subsequent question with the bill. Tell me what is, what issue will the Board of Medical Examiners have discretion over, and what types of work will they not have discretion over on this bill?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Beck, if I understand your question correctly, first the Board oversees podiatrists as well as MDs in its entirety. In terms of writing rules, is that what you're...
Yes, on Section 4, it says surgery of the ankle must be conducted in a hospital and by a podiatric podiatric physician surgeon who needs the qualifications established by rule. So, I mean, I'm trying to figure out what discretion the board is going to have in terms of figuring out who can do what, and or what, or maybe more importantly, what sorts of practices can be undertaken.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Beck, as I read up, they have complete discretion to write rules however they would please. However, they did do an interim study that is included in your packet, the report from that to the legislature, saying what, at that point, they thought that they would as qualifications needed that they would be comfortable with. So I'm assuming that at least would be the starting point of discussion. But you know, there's new members on the board since that happened. The board has taken a position that they're okay with this, with changes that have been made with 606. But it gives them discretion to write whatever rules they would have, whatever within the rulemaking process that they would want to write. They could write it to make it impossible for anyone to qualify.
Mr. Chairman, follow up.
Mr. Beck.
So, if this bill were to pass, and the Board of Medical Examiners said, we don't want any changes, we want to keep the law as it was, we appreciate the legislature granting authority for us to do, to allow for expanded scope of work, but we've decided on further thinking and review and comment that we don't want to. Are we giving them that much discretion, or are there some things here that will fundamentally change regardless of what the board is saying?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Beck, as I read this, they would have discretion to write, so this says, by the podiatric physician surgeon to meet the qualifications for ankle surgery established by rule of the board. They could write it so restrictive that it would qualify nobody in this case. I mean, I guess your question, they would have to write something under this, but they're not bound to what that would be. I guess they would write it just status quo.
Okay, well, maybe we'll hear more about that issue later.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Mr. Williams?
I just want to follow up on that, on the last comment that, you had indicated that your primary concern is the surgical issue that's stated under Section 4. In Sections 2 and 3 of the bill, we have some references to changing language both under 677.805 and under 677.010 with respect to podiatric physician and surgeon, and then there's a section that this is an addendum where it says treating ailments of the foot, and then the new language is ankle and tendons directly attached to and governing the function
of the foot and ankle. From what I heard you say, it's your belief that you already can do that. Am I right?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Williams, it was our understanding that the ankle is part of the foot, which it is. It's also part of the leg, and that's the gray zone that we're trying to clarify. We've been treating ankle sprains, for example, tendonitis, those types of possibly minor problems in comparison to an ankle fracture, for example. Basically in Oregon, under that understanding that the ankle is indeed part of the foot. From a surgical standpoint, there's a question as to where that magic line is drawn, and that's always been a difficulty for the hospitals as well as us as to where that line is drawn. Is it drawn at the top of the what we call talus, which is the ankle mortis? Is it drawn through the ankle mortis up and around the lower part of the leg? Does it include the outer ankle bone and the inner ankle bone, we call it malleoli? And that's the thing we're trying to clear up. We don't want to be marching up the leg. We want to be able to do what we're trying to do, and we want to clarify that zone and where that magic line is so that we can limit what we do and also do it appropriately and professionally.
Exactly. Well, and perhaps this is a question better posed to Mr. Barrows. Is it your belief, Mr. Barrows, that you need the language for clarification purposes on page 2, lines 14 and 15, and lines 29 and 30, and 34 and 35, clarify section 4 as it relates to a podiatric physician or surgeon who needs the qualifications for ankle surgery? Or do you believe that the language on 14 and 15 and 34 and 35 of page 2 of the bill is essentially not only expanding it for those who would perform ankle surgery, but would also be getting clarification on possible expansion to current podiatrists who sound like they're already treating the ankle? I guess that's the issue I'm trying to clarify.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Williams, I would say both. We've tried to work with the Board of Medical Examiners to get qualifications written in, but because of the vagueness of ailments in the human foot, they've been reluctant to take that step, not knowing what the legislature intended in 1969 when that was written. So to answer the first part of your question, those lines serve to clarify the entire scope, but also give some parameters for the Board of Medical Examiners and some authority for them to write ankle surgery.
And just one more follow-up. Doctor, so under the definition, the added definition of ankle and tendons directly attached to the and governing the function of the foot and ankle, is that, in your mind, is that expanding your current scope of practice that you currently have? Apart from surgery, and I'm not sure, I apologize for missing part of your testimony about whether or not you're going to be one of the podiatric physicians who also do the surgery, but apart from the surgery aspect, you view this as actually expanding your ability to treat the ankle more than you currently have?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Williams, no. It is what I currently do. As a matter of fact, the Washington statute basically says ailments of the human foot. And they had the same problem come up, unfortunately, through a trial of a podiatrist who did ankle surgery, and the question was whether or not it was in the scope of practice. And when it all was said and done and the court closed, it indeed was found to be within the scope of practice within that definition. We don't want to have to go through litigation to find out whether it is or isn't and have that debated. At that level, we wanted to go through the proper and appropriate channels through the Board of Medical Examiners and through the legislature to indeed clarify that. So we don't have those kinds of problems arising. And this would indeed do that, and no, it does not extend what I think I do. And I would not be one of those ones who would qualify for the surgery.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, we're on your call again.
But we invite you all up to the area outside and you're able to watch the game.
Our discussion on this bill, and I would like to move out House Bill 2648 today. We'll look and take care of our duties on the floor and then finish up here as quickly as we can. We will stand at ease.
Yeah.
I'll call the order. And it's my intention to proceed with Senate Bill 606. And when we have a lack of a couple more members, we will recess for a few minutes and go into the work session of 2648 and then come back to finish out 606. So I'll now call Nan Heim, John Tung, and Glant. We have to excuse us. We're trying to have our dinner at the same time as we're conducting business here. This is the afternoon.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Nan Heim, here tonight on behalf of the Oregon Association of Orthopedists, over 200 medical doctors statewide specializing in the treatment of disorders and injuries of the musculoskeletal system. And with me to testify in opposition to Senate Bill 606 are John Tung, one of our board members and a board member of the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons, and, of course, Scott Gallant with the Oregon Medical Association. I want to preface our testimony by emphasizing that many of our members work closely with podiatrists and respect their role in treating foot conditions. There are really two issues with this bill, and actually I think this is, I sort of agreed with something Tom Barrow said earlier, that there are two issues. One is ankle surgery by podiatrists, and the second is non-surgical care of the ankle. In terms of the first issue, ankle surgery, that is dealt with in Section 4 of the bill. And although that has received the most attention and people assume it's the one that we object to more, it is in fact the more workable section of the bill. We believe that the Board of Medical Examiners would find that there would be perhaps five or six podiatrists who were certified by the American Board of Podiatric Surgeons who would qualify for this and who we understand are already doing it under hospital credentialing. The second section of the bill is the definition changes on page 2. Throughout that page of podiatric physician and surgeon and of the past practice of podiatry. And that is what is the major scope of practice expansion. And that is our major concern about this bill. And I'm going to have Dr. Tung explain some of those concerns to you. Oh, and may I just say one more thing? And Mr. Chair, I may have been a little optimistic when I told you earlier that I thought I had a compromise. It was an idea which Dr. Zersky, who was here at 2:30 to testify, brought to my attention. He's long gone. He had to go perform a surgery. And it's something I'm still exploring, but I haven't, don't have it yet.
For the record, my name is John Tung. Chairman Simmons and members of the committee. I'm a past president of the Oregon Association of Orthopedic Surgeons and a member of the Board of Directors of the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons. I speak in opposition to this bill. Podiatrists do a very good job of treating elective foot disorders. They do elective surgery at Meridian Park Hospital, where I am past chief of staff. They have no experience treating significant injuries of the foot and ankle. They do not, in my opinion, belong in emergency rooms because they don't have the training. They don't work in our emergency room at Meridian Park Hospital. I've never seen a podiatrist in the emergency room there, at least maybe there's been an occasional situation. The reason for that, according to members of the Board of Directors of the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons, where I'm one of members, 15 board members, is that the chiefs of these large institutions, major institutions, where they are teaching professors, have no podiatrists seeing injured patients in the emergency rooms of these major institutions. So if you look at the scope of practice issue, it says the ankle and tendons directly attached to the governing the function of the foot and ankle. the gastrocnemius complex attaches to the ankle and goes above the knee. So the way that some states have read this language is that this allows the doctors to operate on the knee. So I think that that is not a clarification of scope of practice. And if you read page 134 of the Oregon Revised Statute, the way I read the statute, it defines the foot. And that is not the ankle, in my opinion, and in the opinion of my colleagues. So the program chiefs have told me that the doctors are not trained to treating injuries. I've been operating on ankles for 21 years at Meridian Park Hospital. There is no medical necessity issue because I refuse to answer an emergency room call. I have to treat an injured ankle. And there are over 200 orthopedic surgeons in the state of Oregon who take good care of ankle injuries at this time. Falls are the primary cause of ankle injuries. 95% of the reason for treatment of the ankle is injury. These are generally elderly people who have many other comorbidities. These are not people rebounding basketballs as they are right now. So we have people who have diabetes, who've had strokes, seizures, drug reactions causing their falls. These are often some very frail people. And to have these kind of injuries requires comprehensive evaluation and treatment, which in my opinion should be rendered by a fully qualified physician. If a podiatrist were to operate at Meridian Park Hospital on a senior who had fallen, there would need to be a medical doctor come in and do a history and physical examination on that patient, because if the podiatrist is not a medical doctor, is not qualified to do that evaluation. The critical issue in dealing with ankle injuries is the soft tissue, not the bony parts that you've heard about. Half of the elective surgeries that I've had become infected in the 21 years that I've been treating patients have been ankle fractures. It's a very difficult area. This is very complex work. You have the risk of infection, non-unions, dystrophies, which are painful injuries, and very disabling time loss for those who are injured on job if these injuries are not properly treated. And the salvage operations are fusions and amputations for those severe complications. The majority of ankle injuries are not treated operatively with plates and screws, but are treated with immobilization. But even that treatment is very difficult and requires experience. So I find that this bill is not good for the health and welfare of the people of the state of Oregon, because it expands the scope of practice to a group of less qualified providers for a condition which is already well taken care of by very well qualified orthopedic surgeons in the state of Oregon. So I urge you to vote no on this bill, and I would turn the microphone, if please, the chair over to Scott Gallen.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Scott Gallen. I'm with the Oregon Medical Association. I would merely want to point out a couple of comments or points first, and respond to any questions after that. First of all, though, let me say that I was pleased that Mary Alice Ford chaired but only one of her medical encounters. I, over the years, got to hear about quite a number of them. Unfortunately, most of them were not happy endings, and were always very long stories. And Mary Alice is obviously a wonderful person, still is a wonderful person. One of the proponents of the bill said that this is in regard to clarifying scope of practice, practices that are already done, and permitting or enabling the Board of Medical Examiners to have the regulatory authority to in fact do that in order to address 5 to 8 particular practitioners was one of their primary goals. This bill, as you've heard previously, does appear, in fact, to go beyond that particular primary goal. The bill could, in fact, I think, be narrowed further to, in fact, accomplish that without getting into other ancillary issues. It is interesting and somewhat confusing, actually, on page 2 of the bill, in the definition of podiatry, that there are some very serious caveats involved in that particular subsection. If, for example, a podiatrist is performing involved in a apparently a surgical activity or an activity that requires a general or spinal anesthetic, not only must it be performed in a hospital or ambulatory surgical center, but it also must be done under the supervision of a licensed MD or doctor of osteopathy. It raises to me the question about at least one subpart of section 4, which specifically states the surgery of ankle as defined in this other statute must be conducted in a hospital certified in the manner described in that particular section or an ambulatory surgical center, etc. Now, there are other governing statutes regarding the ability for staff privileges and what one may or may not do under the particular bylaws of those institutions, including ambulatory surgical centers. I think to get to address the specific issue specifically enabling the Board of Medical Examiners to address 5 to 8 particular podiatrists, that all you have to do, that one would delete subsection 1 of section 4, and I would also suggest that only
what would you delete?
I would delete subsection 1 of section 4 so that it just says what you would leave there is that a podiatric surgeon may do ankle surgery under the qualifications established by rule by the Board of Medical Examiners. That specifically addresses, correct.
I'm still not clear where you're at.
Page 3. Delete subsection 1.
Okay.
And make subsection 2 the only subsection of that. I believe, as one of the committee members mentioned, really the other language in the bill, except for, I'm back on page 2, except for the language under what podiatry means, is extraneous. It's not necessary in the legislation from a technical perspective. And if the issue, again, is specifically surgical treatment for small qualified percentage number of people, then you can end the new language after ankle and tendons directly attached to the ankle, period. And then the Board of Medical Examiners, with the advice of the Podiatric Advisory Committee, will adopt specific rules and standards for that. The rest of the bill is new language is not necessary, in my opinion. I'll end my comments there. I don't think that is very difficult to draft, LC draft, quickly. I think we have plenty of time to do that. I'm not sure. The proponents of the bill may be going through the singing, I don't know. But if you will give us some opportunity to at least discuss it with them, they can shake their heads no, and they probably are. But I think that does in fact address the primary issues that have been raised by the proponents.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Mr. Williams.
A couple of questions. First, Dr. Carmen, it's nice to see you again. You were here, I think, on the 55 the 65. You were here on the speed limit issue, if I remember right.
75.
Whatever. Whatever. I drive 80.
Not 58.
Both fast. On the issue of in section 2 of the law on page 2, where it defines painful, do you agree with that as the appropriate definition of ankle?
Lines 14 and 15.
29 and 33. Section 2 of the bill. Where it defines ankle with words that I won't attempt to ruin here.
Yes, I agree with that.
Okay.
I'm sorry, I said.
Okay, I wanted to clarify that. May I follow up, Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Mr. Williams, please.
With respect to, we've heard some testimony here that I won't say is in direct conflict with each other, but I'm so troubled. The doctor of podiatry who just testified indicated that they're currently treating the ankle, and he didn't view the languages 14 and 15 as an expansion. But Dr. Tung, in your comments, I take from that you think that 14 and 15 is an expansion of the current scope of practice for the podiatrist. Am I right about that?
Yeah.
Okay. And your concern, Dr. Tung, is that tendons that are directly attached to or governing the function of the foot extend up the leg.
Above the joint of the knee.
Above the joint of the knee. Now, would there be, but I heard the good doctor of podiatry tell me that they weren't interested in moving up the leg, and I'll avoid the comment I made once in my office about this bill on that point, but they weren't interested in moving up the leg. So is there a way to define this in lines 14 and 15 and again in lines 37 and 38 to stop the movement up the leg? But simply limit them to the ankle, as the ankle is described in section 29 and 30, or line 29 and 30 of the bill.
I don't have any substitute language that could speak against the idea of them treating the ankle.
Okay.
Because these are primarily injuries, and they don't have the basic medical training to treat serious injuries of the ankle. And that's the hard reality of what I have to say to you.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, when I look at this packet given us, it talks about places, states where the treated, where the podiatrists work on different foot only or foot and ankle. I just wonder if anybody has any information from places where podiatrists are already treating the ankle, about whether that has been a problem in those localities where that has happened.
Well, I would hope that at some time in the future the managed care organizations would have that kind of data for you, but I don't believe that data exists.
Do you have a chance to
answer
the question or find
and right, and that's what made me ask the question. This is occurring in our state. So what is? I hear your concern that there will be some bad results of podiatrists expanding the scope as they are suggesting in this bill. And I wanted to know in other states where that has happened, whether there's been a problem. That would be, to me, give me some guidance about whether there was something to be concerned about here or not.
Mr. Chair, Representative Piercy, I too have asked that question and have had the various national organizations tell me that because of patient confidentiality and managed care restrictions, they haven't collected it.
Mr. Chairman,
Dr. Williams.
Well, I guess, and I looked at this as well, it seems to me as I compare this, though, with only 13 states being foot-only states and everybody else having some balance of that, currently, though, you'd have to agree, I guess, that Oregon is in the minority on limiting scope of practice to foot-only, currently with diabetes. Am I right about that?
I tried to make that argument for the state bill a few years ago, and it didn't get me anywhere with Oregon legislation. I think you need to look at this bill on the merits of the principles of education and experience and the fact that there's no medical necessity to expand the scope of practice of podiatrists into ankle injuries. I think that I'm proud to be an Oregonian. We're frequently first or last on many things, and I think I'd like to be last on this issue if we have.
Mr. Chair, Representative Williams, the reason I compiled that list was to show that it isn't just a blanket authority for all the states to do it, and also to show because at least one legislator said to me, why don't you just let this happen and have this be over? And we do not believe for 1 minute that it will be over, because there will constantly be that this is connected to that and that's connected to that, and we don't think it will end. And I wanted to show that, in fact, in some states, it has not.
I'm curious whether there would be a way to let the Board of Medical Examiners be allowed to deal with some of these definitions, the ankle definition, or the language in Section 1 on page 2 on 13 and, or 14 and 15. I wonder if that issue could be resolved by the Board of Medical Examiners, that they could sort of define who would be granting them, obviously, the policy option of allowing podiatry to expand their practice. So would they be able to do that through some of the definitional changes?
I would say that this, my response to that would be that the first question of the Board of Medical Examiners would be to define the Oregon statute as it's presently written. As I understand it, it says the foot. And if they are allowing a podiatrist to treat ankle injuries in their offices today, I'd like to know from the Board of Medical Examiners whether that's presently a violation of the existing statute, because I believe it is.
Further questions? Representative
Wayne? Chairman Zita. Doctor, what are the two little knobs on the side of my ankle called?
The Malay line.
The Malay line? Is that plural?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I'm just trying to figure out how we can find the ankle at a stopping point.
It just lays it off the ground.
Do you have a follow-up question, Representative Williams?
No, I'm just thinking about an amendment.
Okay, Representative Edwards?
I got to ask the obvious question. What orthopedist, who licensed the tree? What can you do?
Orthopedic surgeons are licensed to treat the entire musculoskeletal system. It's easier to say what we don't treat. We don't treat broken jaws. We don't treat broken ribs. I tell my kids, they're teenagers, and they tell their friends that their dad treats arms and legs, which means that I don't treat the spine by choice, even though I'm trained to treat that. I'm a Colonel Sanders orthopedist, no next, no best.
All up for time. Well, I guess, yeah, just when, as far as medical school, when psychiatrists are trained, that's obviously a very select discipline. Is that correct? So therefore,
the orthopedic residency is the most sought after residency in postgraduate education in medicine. 25 years ago, it was, you had to be had a strong back and be in the lower third of your class to be an orthopedic surgeon, and that's no longer true. You now have to be AOA, which is the top 10% just to apply. To have your application opened at LHSU, you have to be AOA. I was not AOA. I have 10 years of post. I graduated from Northwestern University, went to medical school for 4 years, had a year of internship, had a year of general surgery, both of those 2 years were at OHSU, and went to San Francisco for 3 years of additional residency training and a year of fellowship in knee and hand surgery. I've had 10 years of postgraduate education to become an orthopedic surgeon at the young age of 32. That was as young as you could be to hang out your shingle. And of course, at the time that I was going through training, most of the additional experience was in Vietnam.
One last question. So you mentioned there were something like 200 orthopedics in Oregon.
276.
Of those, I would assume some specialize, right? Correct? Some specialize more in foot, ankle, leg, and...
Yes, there are three really world-class orthopedic surgeons who've done foot and ankle fellowships who I refer to when I have really difficult problems, who are, I call, tertiary referral specialists in that area.
One last thing. I'll make that. Sorry to keep visiting you on this, but is there an issue of you said there was no problem, but is there an issue of being able to get healthcare treatment in other parts of the state? I don't know where you're from, is this an issue of trying to give some parts of the state a different, some ability that you can't get access to orthopedics?
No, there's no access difficulty. We have a broad distribution of orthopedic surgeons in every community hospital in the state of Oregon.
I referred to those, some of my colleagues as the second oldest scope of practice dispute in this building.
Mm-hmm.
That's because I didn't want to give it first building. I don't know what the first would be, but as far as I know, this item has been an item of discussion in the 95 and 97, and now in this session. It probably predates 95, I'm sure, because I haven't done the research, but I would guess that it does. There's two elements in this bill. The one relative to the definition of podiatry, and the second relative to the certification of podiatrist for surgery by the BMA. Some of the testimony appears to be that there are probably a half a dozen podiatrists that could meet the certification requirements from the BME for the surgery that's indicated here. Now, I haven't heard an overt objection by at least two of the people testifying to that portion. I don't know if Dr. Tung, who is my constituent, would object to that portion of the...
I would.
You will. That's the agreement. The second is, as I told Dr. Tung and I've told everybody surrounding this, I feel terribly inadequate for scope of practice issues. Why should I be up here judging what the scope of practice should be for a podiatrist versus an orthopedic surgeon? My background consists of a couple of graduate courses in biology. But I would say, I would hope that sometime both groups come to some agreement so that we had something that was a little bit more definitive than what's in the current statute for podiatry, which is ailments of the human foot. That seems like to me to be a very unclear definition. I mean, in the sense that, it might not be unclear to some people. I mean, orthopedic surgeon might say that it doesn't include the ankle. A podiatrist might say that the ankle is part of the foot. And the tendons that are connected are still part of the operating of it. So it would seem to me that somehow the groups would try to come to some definition of what the scope of practice is that's better than what we have in statute. That's my frustration. Because I think that the definition in statute is not particularly clear.
Representative Devlin, I believe that you will hear this scope of practice issue every session. What's really happening is that foot and ankle care is about 25% of the musculoskeletal market, if you will. And the number of podiatrists being trained every year is about two-thirds the number of orthopedic surgeons being trained every year. So there's a collision course here for turf, as Mary Alice Ford so delicately put it. And so it's going to be at the forefront, and they're going to continue to push to expand their scope of practice. But what I would like to have, and we have competition in orthopedic surgeons in their area. As a hand surgeon, one-third of all the hand surgeons that are my colleagues as a certified hand surgeon are plastic surgeons. They're well qualified. I welcome them as colleagues. In spine, we have competition with neurosurgeons who are well qualified to take care of the spine. I have no problem with that. I refer to neurosurgeons frequently on the issues of spine because I choose not to take care of the spine. My problem with allowing podiatrists to treat ankle injuries is that they do not have the qualifications to do so in a way that would benefit the people of the state of Oregon. And that's why I ask you to oppose the bill.
You understand a little bit of my frustration with this, because I would suspect if this bill passed that Mr. Gallant and Ms. Hine would be back in here with the bill next session to try to more narrow what's being proposed here. If it doesn't pass, I expect that the podiatrists and their lobbyists to be back here next session with another bill.
My expectations would be quite different. My expectations would be if the bill passes, that's a one-way street. Once you expand scope of practice, I have never heard of anyone going backwards on a scope of practice issue. And similarly, if the bill does not pass, yes, indeed, the podiatrists will be back, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, could I make one clarification, I believe, about comments made earlier as well?
We could have you sit the next week, please.
John Hamill with the Oregon Medical Association. I have spoken with both the medical director and the executive director of the DMA. They are neutral on this bill. And as far as I know, and I've had direct conversations with both, I just to put that on there.
Yeah,
Representative Lamb?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wanted to ask Dr. Tung again to try to get an understanding for his view about any treatment of the ankle. Is it your opinion, Doctor, that there is nothing with respect to ankle treatment that you think that a podiatrist is qualified to do? I mean, for example, I'll just give you an example. Do you think they are not capable, for example, of casting a fracture?
I don't think they have the training that an orthopedic surgeon has, and an orthopedic surgeon in this state is always available to take care of that injury and would do a better job.
Do we allow other medical doctors that aren't orthopedic surgeons to cast fractures in Oregon?
Yes, we do. They're medical doctors.
Okay. Do we allow physician's assistants to cast fractures in Oregon?
Not in my practice.
In any other place?
And if they did, they would do so under the direct supervision of a medical doctor.
Okay. And direct supervision is defined as you come in, you look at the fracture, you describe what kind of cast ought to go on, and then the PA comes in and casts it? Or does the PA look at it, make a general diagnosis, and just conclude?
In my practice in 21 years, I've put on every cast that every patient that I've ever taken care of has had. I put it on myself. So I don't know of the practices of other groups of doctors per se, but I have treated a number of patients who've had poor outcomes from other facilities where they have not had what I would consider to be adequate supervision by a medical doctor, and that's why I'm concerned about these injuries and how they're treated, because when it comes to the bad outcomes, they will end up in my office.
And either any of you can answer this, but I believe that under current law, and you can correct me if I'm wrong here, but I believe that certified nurse practitioners do on occasion set simple fractures.
Now that's news to this doctor. I've never heard of that.
You know, a rural clinic, I think, the certified nurse practitioners that work there do.
When I started practice in 1978, it's just about the era when general practitioners were getting out of fracture treatment because they were concerned about the liability, and orthopedic surgeons were numerous enough in the state of Oregon 20 years ago that they were available to take care of these injuries, and patients got better care that way, and so that's really part of the evolution of specialty care in the state of Oregon, in my experience.
Dr. Pung, I just want to clarify one thing for the record. This is one of those questions, again, as a layman. Your concern is surgery in the ankle, correct?
No. The majority of these ankle injuries will be treated without surgery. They'll be treated with cast immobilization.
Oh, okay.
Certainly the greatest potential risk, I feel, is the cases that are treated operatively.
Okay, but you're concerned also about what you've indicated there also. As you said, if you're casting them. So you would say that you would not want a physiatrist to get into a position of setting a fracture of the ankle or something like that and casting it.
Correct.
Yeah.
Further questions? Mr. Gallant, would you review for us once again your suggested amendment to the bill?
My gross version. Yes, Mr. Chairman. Again, for the record, my name is Scott Allen, Oregon American Association. I would delete the language online, new language online. Page 2. On line 14 and 15.
You're deleting all new language?
Yes.
All the new language?
Yes. And I'll explain why in a minute. Well, you probably have to leave, I'm sorry. Do the same thing on lines 34 and 35. Do the same thing on lines 34 and 35.
Mr. Chair, clarification, you delete all new language and those lines you're taking. Did you say leave the word ankle on line 14?
You'd have to put a word in there. In other words, the ankle is going to be defined as provided in subsection 2. All right.
Are you or aren't you leaving the word ankle on line 14?
Yes, I'm going to leave the word ankle.
You've left the word ankle on line 14. All right.
And the same would be true in line 34.
In line 34, it goes endless of the human foot and ankle,
period. You leave the definition of ankle in the bill. Then podiatry would be defined as means of diagnosis for the medical, physical treatment of ailments of the human foot and ankle, period. Section 4 of the bill on lines 1 and 2 would be deleted. Subsection 1 would be deleted entirely, and subsection 1 would be, or 2 would become 1. So that would, in my opinion, specifically authorize the Board of Medical Examiners to determine specific qualifications for what I understand to be the 5 to 8 podiatric surgeons who meet the specific qualifications according to the American Podiatric Association.
Okay, questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Barr,
I would like to hear from the proponents of the bill on this
next time. So if you had any questions, these individuals before we let them step down. Okay, thank you. Members of the committee, it's the in the third quarter, 52 Portland, 51 Utah.
7 minutes left in third quarter.
Up by one.
Yeah.
I'm not watching. Might need a heart.
We're saving your heart.
And you don't do heart.
Another one does save
We'll get Mr. Chairman Tom Barrows. We have time to kind of digest this a little bit. A little bit more time.
We obviously need to sort of say, I'm not even sure exactly what was being proposed, or I tried to make those as quickly as I could. I have a concern, though, that, you know, we've been working on this for two sessions, and to come in at the last minute with proposed change, as you read in the letter from Representative Lewis, have been trying to work on a compromise over time. It's a little tough for us to now sit down with some brand new changes and try and give you an answer.
What I would be willing to do is give us any comments you have right now, and then we can stand at ease, or we can repost the bill for Monday or Tuesday.
I would feel more comfortable with them having some time to work on this. I've watched this go through two sessions already, it seems like there's little gets set up and people think they're reaching it and they just keep going.
Mr. Chair.
President Welch.
I'm going to refer to former Representative Dennis Lewis' letter. It shows that they OMA was requested to work some details out with the podiatrist here and found out that, as stated in this letter, that OMA's position looks like there is no compromise. I see at this point in time there is a proposed one in the language that we have here. It's been 4 years, and we've come this far. And we better probably take a little more time here to see if they can work it out.
I was just going to recommend, it looks like we're going to call again, and maybe we get the amendments in LC form between now and the next time the committee meets and give them an opportunity to digest what
Mr. Chair?
So this would be Wednesday. Yes.
Can I just make a comment? Regarding some of the amendments that were proposed, these rules that were written under the direction of the BME, and it's a compromise on the part of the Oregon Portage Medical Association. It was not offered by the OMA or by the orthopedic members when we met one session ago when we had our interim committee.
Interim in
96. We attempted after two meetings to arrive at some conclusion. No report was given by the OMA. And so, I guess my concern with this is that we basically accepted these amendments, if you will, in order to get to this position. And yet now we're trying to redraft again and again and again, and I don't think it changes the intent of the bill.
And the Board of Medical Examiners has looked at this version and said that they're okay with it.
The definition of the flip sentence and so on was their language, if you will, in our compromise to reach this issue.
Why don't we repost this for Tuesday or Wednesday? I guess Wednesday's the earliest day we can do this again, and we will give you a chance to look at this and have to visit the members of the committee a little bit and plan on moving the bill or put a work session at that point. Hopefully, Monday we'll be home. This is a welcome Monday thing. Thank you so much. I'm here by myself. Okay, so we will adjourn the public hearing and we will recess the committee. Reconvene and open a work session on House Bill 2648. Representative Maddox is handing out amendments. Max Williams.
Kevin
and
I
will
feel a lot of
it. Max and Santa Lake.
We're both lawyers and we both have extra money.
You do. Maxie. Maxwell. They're just handing out some amendments, and
And Mr. Representative Williams, if you would be kind enough to go through
Mr. Chairman, staff six amendments, colleagues, simply delete the entire Section 4 of the bill. I've had a number of discussions with various parties regarding this bill, and while there's lots of different opinions about other sections other than Section 4, what Section 4 does currently is for all purposes, not just for purposes of agency lobbying, but for all purposes, broadens the definition of lobbying to include submitting proposed legislation to any legislative official and discussing proposed legislation with any legislative official. That definition would apply not only to agency lobbyists, but for everybody else who lobbies within the legislature. I think there are a lot of concerns about the broadening of that language, and the Dash 6 Amendment simply removes the entire Section 4 of the bill. Convening work session, Mr. Chairman, I would offer the Dash 6 Amendment at this time and make a motion.
You then move the Dash 6 Amendment to House Bill 2648. Representative Williams makes the motion. Colleagues, we've been over this bill several times previously, and this is our latest amendment to the bill. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair, six. Are you going to copy them?
I can hand it out to you, Representative Wells.
I'm in there.
They're hand-delivered. Not hand-delivered. You got mine.
Mr. Chair?
There they are.
Okay. Refresh my memory. Have we adopted the Dash 2 through 5 already?
2, 3, and 5.
Have been adopted.
Yes.
Or have been adopted.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
You don't have to do the definition.
Yes, we're about to.
Mr. Chairman, I'm happy to re-explain it if you need to.
What the Dash 6 amendments do essentially is they delete Section 4 of the bill, which just simply broadens the current definition of lobbyists. That definition, the broadening of that definition raised a number of concerns, including although they never took an official position, I was contacted by the representatives of the Capital Club and others who were concerned about the broadening definition of lobbying, because that statute doesn't apply simply to agency lobbyists, but to everybody else who registers or who even doesn't register but simply operates under the lower hours provision as defined through both statute and rule of the Government Standards and Practices Commission. So the Dash 6 Amendment simply reserved the current definition of lobbying in the statute with no expansion. I discussed these amendments not only with the groups I told you about, but also earlier yesterday and again today with the proponents of the bill. And although I'm sure Mr. DiLorenzo is watching the last quarter of the game at this point, or at least
we're up by 8 points.
He had no objection to the amendment and was willing to do this. It does somewhat limit, I mean, their attempt was to actually expand what constitutes lobbying for purposes, at least within the agency lobbying portion of this bill, to pick up more individuals who would be having those contacts with the legislative assembly or any they associated therewith. So, you know, you can take the amendment however you want it. I'm doing it from a practitioner standpoint, having practiced in the area of representing individuals and entities involved in lobbying with the Government Standards and Practices Commission, and this is a definition, colleagues, that frankly I don't think we want to screw around with. And based on that, I've offered the amendment, and I don't believe at least there's anyone opposing leaving the definition as it currently stands within the statute.
Further discussion?
We're gonna send this bill to the voters, is that right?
Section 5.
Section 5 does.
You got it.
This is very nearly identical to a bill that was passed last session through both houses of the legislature and then vetoed by the governor. So this time it has a referral clause on it.
We have not seen this.
Nope. It has not been to the voters. Mr. Chamoff, did you have anything to add for our enlightenment?
No, sir.
Oh,
Harry was going to go nominate you.
I have no concern for the American amount of referrals we're sending out of this party.
Oh, well, that is a, certainly a good point. There have been a number of them, and I think they're going to get placed on individual
files. Well, it's in now, huh?
I don't believe this has any language that specifically it does. This is the next general election, though, for us to
state.
Sure. You're going to hear the public one.
Sure.
This is Beck.
I'm going to, after we get done adopting the dash sixes, I'm going to, make, I don't know if I can make a motion, but I'm going to would like to discuss whether we would like to delete Section 5 from the bill.
Okay, well, we have a motion before us. Any further discussion on the motion? Mr. Devins.
I'm going to do something I usually don't do here. I'm going to vote against the amendment. That's because if the amendment doesn't pass, I think all those members of the Capitol Club may be contributed to the campaign in opposition to the bill.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, this is obviously the strategy of never try to make a bad bill better that Representative Devlin is attempting.
Well, in this particular case,
I would just say that the danger in that course is that if you defeat the amendment, we completely open a whole new undeclared area with respect to the definition of lobbying. And it's going to be an area that, frankly, affects potentially all of us at some point. But it certainly is going to affect, Mr. Chamoff and the way his office deals with people, because he is part of the legislative. I think this is it assembly. I don't have it in front of me right now. It's just a bad idea. So vote the way you want to vote on the amendment, but it's the right thing to do.
Whenever the Representative Liger speaks, it's always the right thing.
Indeed.
Okay, would you please call the roll on the adoption of the Dash 6 amendments to House Bill 2648?
Representative Gardner.
Excuse.
Representative Madden.
Aye.
Representative Kirky.
Aye.
Representative Starr.
Aye.
Representative Welch.
Aye.
Representative Williams.
Aye.
Representative Simmons.
Aye.
And the Dash 6 amendments, House Bill 2648, are adopted.
Mr. Chair.
With who's back?
Yeah.
With the chair or any members of the committee, Andrew, want Jeff entertaining conceptual amendment to delete Section 5 from the bill, which is the referral to the voters of this issue of such great weight. After we've just passed 8 referrals, constitutional referrals to the voters, I guess I'm struck. I understand. Nevertheless, a referral.
Mr. Chair.
So we'll take conceptual.
Mr. Byer. I give it out to Representative Peck that he is on the government office to inquire whether the government would sign the bill without a loan to give any assurances that he would.
Well, I don't know. I'm voting against the bill still. I just trying to help you guys.
Well, would we consider conceptual amendments to the sunset clause on this for 4 years so that when we elect a Republican government, we won't have
a Mr. Chairman, since I believe I may have started this degeneration in conversation, I would hope that we would proceed to a vote.
Okay. Any more? The other motion, Star?
Okay.
The other motion on the bill
is Mr. Chair.
Buyer.
I move House Bill 2648 as amended to the floor of the House to be passed on the nation.
Okay, calls for the motion before us. Move House Bill 2648 as amended to the floor of the DuPont recommendation. We have had other discussion about various conceptual amendments. We do have this motion before us. Any further discussion?
Knocked
out?
Yeah.
Mr. Chair,
any objection?
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative.
And for purposes of meeting the two requirements, I'll join representation.
Thank you. All righty. So I already talked to Prince of the State before the House of the Federal Foundation. I will sign a carrier.
I know.
You
will have yourself on the final. I'm representing that.
And to the other business before the committee, we are adjourned.
Let's just get them off.